okay?"
Hermione said. She didn't fall over with relief, but only because she was already sitting down.
"Shall we get lunch?"
Harry said cautiously. Hermione nodded. Yes, lunch sounded good. For real, this time. She carefully began to push herself off the stone floor, wincing as her body screamed at her. Harry pointed his wand at her and said,
"Wingardium Leviosa!"
Hermione blinked as the huge weight on her legs diminished to something bearable. A smile quirked across Harry's face.
"You can lift something without being able to hover it completely," he said. "Remember that experiment?"
Hermione smiled back helplessly, although she thought she ought to still be angry. And she started walking back toward the Great Hall, feeling remarkably and wonderfully light on her feet, as Harry carefully kept his wand trained on her. He only managed to keep it up for 5 minutes, but it was the thought that counted. Minerva looked at Dumbledore. Dumbledore gazed back inquiringly at her.
"Did you understand any of that?"
the headmaster said, sounding bemused. It had been the most complete and utter gibberish that Minerva could ever remember hearing. She was feeling a bit embarrassed about having summoned the headmaster to hear it, but she'd been given explicit instructions.
"I'm afraid not,"
Professor McGonagall said primly.
"So,"
Dumbledore said. The silver beard swung away from her. The old wizard's twinkling gaze looked elsewhere once more.
"You suspect you might be able to do something that other wizards can't do. Something we think is impossible."
The three of them stood within the headmaster's private transfiguration workroom, where the shining phoenix of Dumbledore's Patronus had told her to bring Harry, moments after her own Patronus had reached him. Light shone down through the skylights and illuminated the great seven-pointed alchemical diagram drawn in the centre of the circular room, showing it to be a little dusty, which saddened Minerva. Transfiguration research was one of Dumbledore's great enjoyments, and she'd known how pressed for time he'd been lately, but not that he was this pressed. And now Harry Potter was going to waste even more of the headmaster's time. But she certainly couldn't blame Harry for that. He had done the proper thing in coming to her to say that he'd had an idea for doing something in Transfiguration that was currently believed to be impossible, and she herself had done exactly what she had been told to do. She had ordered Harry to be quiet and not discuss anything with her until she had consulted the headmaster and they'd finished moving to a secure location. If Harry had started out by saying what specifically he thought he could do, she wouldn't have bothered.
Look, I know it's hard to explain," Harry said, sounding a little embarrassed. What it adds up to is that what you believe conflicts with what scientists believe, in a case where I'd genuinely expect scientists to know more than wizards."
Minerva would have sighed out loud if Dumbledore hadn't seemed to be taking the whole thing very seriously. Harry's idea stemmed from simple ignorance, nothing more. If you changed half of a metal ball into glass, the whole ball had a different form. To change the part was to change the whole, and that meant removing the whole form and replacing it with a different one. What would it even mean to transfigure only half of a metal ball? That the metal ball as a whole had the same form as before, but half that ball now had a different form?
"Mr. Potter,"
said Professor McGonagall,
"what you want to do isn't just impossible, it's illogical. If you change half of something, you did change the whole."
"Indeed," said Dumbledore. "But Harry is the hero, so he may be able to do things that are logically impossible."
Minerva would have rolled her eyes, if she hadn't gone numb a long time ago.
"Supposing it was possible," said Dumbledore, "can you think of any reason why the results would differ in any way from ordinary transfiguration?"
Minerva frowned. The fact that the concept was, literally, unimaginable was presenting her with some difficulty, but she tried to take it at face value. A transfiguration imposed on only half of a metal ball.
"Strange things happening at the interface," said Minerva. "But that should be no different than transfiguring the object as a whole into a form with two different parts."
Dumbledore nodded.
"That is my own thought as well. And, Harry, if your theory is correct, it implies that what you want to do is exactly like any other transfiguration, only applied to a part of the subject rather than the whole. No changes at all?"
"Yes," Harry said firmly. "That's the whole point."
Dumbledore looked at her again.
"Minerva, can you think of any reason whatsoever why that would be dangerous?"
"No,"
said Minerva after she had finished searching through her memory.
"Likewise, myself," said the headmaster. "All right, then. Since this ought to be exactly analogous to ordinary transfiguration in all respects, and since we cannot think of any reason whatsoever why it would be dangerous, I think that the second degree of caution will suffice."
Minerva was surprised, but she didn't object. Dumbledore was by far her senior in transfiguration, and he had tried literally thousands of new transfigurations without ever choosing a degree of caution that was too low. He had used transfiguration in combat, and he was still alive. If the headmaster thought the second degree was enough, it was enough. That Harry was certainly going to fail was, of course, completely irrelevant. The two of them started setting up the wards and detection webs. The most important web was the one that checked to make sure no transfigured material had entered the air. Harry would be enclosed in a separate shell of force with its own air supply, just to be certain, only his wand allowed to leave the shield, and the interface tight. They were inside Hogwarts, so they couldn't automatically apparate out any material that showed signs of spontaneous combustion, but they could launch it out of a skylight almost as fast. The windows all folded outward for exactly that reason. Harry himself would go out a different skylight at the first sign of trouble. Harry watched them working, his face looking a little frightened.
"Don't worry,"
said Professor McGonagall in the middle of her running description.
"This almost certainly won't be necessary, Mr. Potter. If we expected anything to go wrong, you would not be allowed to try. It's just ordinary precautions for any transfiguration no one's ever tried before."
Harry swallowed and nodded. And a few minutes later, Harry was strapped into the safety chair and resting his wand against a metal ball. One ant, based on his current test scores, should have been too large for him to transfigure in less than 30 minutes. And, a few minutes after that, Minerva was leaning against the wall, feeling faint. There was a small patch of glass on the ball where Harry's wand had rested. Harry didn't say, "I told you so," but the smug look on his sweating face said it for him. Dumbledore was casting analytic charms on the ball, looking more and more intrigued by the moment. 30 years had melted off his face.
"Fascinating," said Dumbledore. "It's exactly as he claimed. He simply transfigured a part of the subject without transfiguring the whole. You say it's really just a conceptual limitation, Harry?"
"Yes," Harry said, "but a deep one. Just knowing it had to be a conceptual limitation wasn't enough. I had to suppress the part of my mind that was making the error and think instead about the underlying reality that scientists figured out."
"Truly fascinating," Dumbledore said. "I take it that for any other wizard to do the same would require months of study, if they could do it at all. May I ask you to partially transfigure some other subjects?"
Half an hour later, Minerva was feeling equally bewildered, but considerably reassured about the safety issues. It was the same, aside from being logically impossible.
"You believe that's enough, Headmaster?"
Minerva said finally.
"I suspect partial transfiguration is more tiring than the ordinary sort."
"Getting less so with practice,"
said the exhausted and pale boy, voice unsteady.
"But, yeah, you've got that right."
The process of extracting Harry from the ward took another minute, and then Minerva escorted him to a much more comfortable chair, and Dumbledore produced an ice cream soda.
"Congratulations, Mr. Potter,"
said Professor McGonagall, and meant it. She would have bet almost anything against that working.
"Congratulations, indeed,"
said Dumbledore.
"Even I did not make any original discoveries in transfiguration before the age of 14. Not since the day of Dorothy Sendjak has any genius flowered so early."
Thanks,
Harry said, sounding a little surprised.
"Nonetheless," Dumbledore said thoughtfully, "I think it would be most wise to keep this happy event a secret, at least for now. Harry, did you discuss your idea with any other person before you spoke to Professor McGonagall?"
There was silence.
Harry said, "I don't want to turn anyone over to the Inquisition, but I did tell one other student."
The word almost exploded from Professor McGonagall's lips.
"What? You discussed a completely novel form of transfiguration with a student before consulting a recognized authority? Do you have any idea how irresponsible that was?"
"I'm sorry," said Harry. "I didn't realize."
The boy looked appropriately frightened, and Minerva felt something inside her relax. At least Harry understood how foolish he'd been.
"You must swear Miss Granger to secrecy," Dumbledore said gravely, "and do not tell anyone else, unless there is an extremely good reason for it, and they too have sworn."
Why?
Harry said. Minerva was wondering the same thing. Once again, the headmaster was thinking too far ahead for her to keep up.
"Because you can do something that no one else will believe you can do," Dumbledore said. "Something completely unexpected. It may prove to be your critical advantage, Harry, and we must preserve it. Please trust me on this."
Professor McGonagall nodded, her firm face showing nothing of her inner confusion.
"Please do, Mr. Potter," she said.
"All right,"
Harry said slowly.
"Once we have finished examining your materials,"
Dumbledore added,
"you may practice partial transfiguration on glass to steel, and steel to glass only, with Miss Granger to act as your spotter. Naturally, if either of you suspect any symptom of any form of transfiguration sickness, inform a professor at once."
Just before Harry left the workroom, with his hand on the door handle, the boy turned back and said,
"As long as we're here, have either of you noticed anything different about Professor Snape?"
"Different?"
said the headmaster. Minerva didn't let her wry smile show on her face. Of course the boy was apprehensive about the evil potions master, since he had no way of knowing why Severus was to be trusted. It would have been odd, to say the least, explaining to Harry that Severus was still in love with his mother.
"I mean, has his behaviour changed recently in any way?"
said Harry.
"Not that I have seen,"
the headmaster said slowly.
"Why do you ask?"
Harry shook his head.
"I don't want to prejudice your own observations by saying. Keep an eye out, maybe."
That sent a quiver of unease through Minerva in a way that no outright accusation of Severus could have. Harry bowed to both of them respectfully and took his leave.
"Albus,"
Minerva said after the boy had gone,
"how did you know to take Harry seriously? You would have thought his idea merely impossible."
The old wizard's face turned grave.
"The same reason it must be kept secret, Minerva. The same reason I told you to come to me if Harry made any such claim. Because it is a power that Voldemort knows not."
The words took a few seconds to sink in, and then the cold shiver went down her spine, as it always did when she remembered. It had started out as an ordinary job interview. Sybil Trelawney applying for the position of Professor of Divination.
"The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord approaches, born to those who have thrice defied him, born as the seventh month dies, and the Dark Lord will mark him as his equal, but he will have power the Dark Lord knows not, and either must destroy all but a remnant of the other, for those two different spirits cannot exist in the same world."
Those dreadful words, spoken in that terrible booming voice, didn't seem to fit something like partial transfiguration.
"Perhaps not, then,"
Dumbledore said after Minerva tried to explain.
"I confess I had been hoping for something that would help in finding Voldemort's Horcrux, wherever he may have hidden it. But,"
the old wizard shrugged,
"prophecies are tricky things, Minerva, and it's best to take no chances. The smallest thing may prove decisive if it remains unexpected."
"And what do you suppose he meant about Severus?"
said Minerva.
"There I have no idea,"
sighed Dumbledore.
"Unless Harry is making a move against Severus, and thought that an open question might be taken seriously, where a direct allegation would be dismissed. And if that was indeed what happened, Harry correctly reasoned that I would not trust that it was so. Let us simply keep watch, without prejudice, as he asks."
Aftermath 1.
Hermione,
Harry said in a very small voice.
I think I owe you a really, really, really big apology.
Aftermath 2. Alyssa Cornfoot's eyes were slightly glazed as she gazed upon the potions master giving her class a stern lecture, holding up a tiny bronze bean and saying something about screaming puddles of human flesh. Ever since the start of this year, she'd been having trouble listening in potions. She kept staring at their awful, mean, greasy professor and fantasizing about special detentions. There was probably something really wrong with her, but she just couldn't seem to stop doing it.
"Oh,"
Alyssa said then. Snape had just flicked the bronze bean unerringly at Alyssa's forehead.
"Miss Cornfoot," said the potions master, his voice cutting. "This is a delicate potion, and if you cannot pay attention, you will hurt your classmates, not just yourself. See me after class."
The last four words didn't help her any, but she tried harder, and managed to get through the day without melting anyone. After class, Alyssa approached the desk. Part of her wanted to stand there meekly, with her face abashed and her hands clasped penitently behind her back, just in case, but some quiet instinct told her this might be a bad idea. So, instead, she just stood there, with her face neutral, in a posture that was very proper for a young lady, and said,
"Professor?"
"Miss Cornfoot," Snape said, without looking up from the sheets he was grading. "I do not return your affections. I begin to find your stares disturbing, and you will restrain your eyes henceforth. Is that quite clear?"
"Yes,"
said Alyssa in a strangled squeak, and Snape dismissed her, and she fled the classroom with her cheeks flaming like molten lava.
"Hello there, it's me, Jack Voraces. Thanks for listening so far. You reached the end of what I've recorded thus far. The next chapter will be published next Tuesday, Tuesday the 15th. I also want to invite you to my Discord server, where you can listen to live recordings. We have a good laugh, discuss the story, and decide on character voices together. Come and join. I really hope to see you there. You can find a link in the description or just Google search Voraces Tavern Discord. You legends."
Chapter 29. Egocentric Bias. There'd been a sinking feeling in Hermione's stomach lately, every time she heard the other students talking about her and Harry. She'd been in a shower stall this morning when she'd overheard a conversation between Morag and Padma that had been the last straw piled on top of quite a lot of other straws. She was starting to think that getting involved in a rivalry with Harry Potter had been a terrible mistake. If she'd just stayed away from Harry Potter, she could have been Hermione Granger, the brightest academic star of Hogwarts, who was earning more points for Ravenclaw than anyone. She wouldn't have been as famous as the boy who lived, but she would have been famous for herself. Instead, the boy who lived had an academic rival, and her name happened to be Hermione Granger. And worse, she had gone on a date with him. The idea of getting into a romance with Harry had seemed like an appealing idea at first. She'd read books like that, and if there was anyone in Hogwarts who was a candidate for the heroine's love interest, it was obviously Harry Potter. Bright, funny, famous, sometimes scary. So, she had forced Harry into going on a date with her. And now, She was his love interest. Or worse, one of the options on his dinner menu. She'd been in a shower stall that morning, and just about to turn on the water when she'd heard giggles coming from outside. And she'd heard Morag talking about how that Muggle-born girl probably wouldn't fight hard enough to win against Ginevra Weasley, and Padma speculating that Harry Potter might decide he wanted both. It was like they didn't understand that girls had options on their dinner menus and boys fought over them. But that wasn't even the part that hurt, really. It was that when she scored 98 on one of Professor McGonagall's tests, the news wasn't that Hermione Granger had scored the highest in the class. The news was that Harry Potter's rival had scored 7 more points than him. If you got too close to the boy who lived, you became part of his story. You didn't get your own. And the thought had come to Hermione that she should just walk away. But that would have been too sad. But she did want to get back what she had accidentally given away by letting herself become known as Harry's rival. She wanted to be a separate person again, instead of Harry Potter's third leg. Was that too much to ask? It was a hard trap to climb out of once you fell in. No matter how high you scored in class, even if you did something that deserved a special dinner-time announcement, it just meant that you were rivaling Harry Potter again. But she thought she'd come up with a way. Something to do that wouldn't be seen as pushing up on the opposite end of Harry Potter's seesaw. It would be hard. It would go against her nature. She would have to fight someone very evil. And she would need to ask someone even more evil for help. Hermione raised her hand to knock upon that terrible door. She hesitated. Hermione realized she was being silly and raised her hand a bit higher. She tried to knock again. Her hand quite failed to touch the door, and then the door swung open anyway. "Dear me," said the spider, sitting in its web. "Was it really that hard to lose a single Quirrell point, Miss Granger?" Hermione stood there with her hand raised, her cheeks growing pink. It had been. "Well, Miss Granger, I shall be merciful," said the evil Professor Quirrell. "Consider it already lost. There, I have taken a hard choice from you. Are you not grateful?"
"Professor Quirrell?"
Hermione managed to say in a voice that squeaked a little.
"I have a lot of Quirrell points, don't I?"
"You do, indeed," said Professor Quirrell. "Though one less than you had before. Terrible, isn't it? Just think, if I don't like your reason for coming here, you could lose another 50. Maybe I'd take them away, one by one by one." Hermione's cheeks were going even redder.
"You're really evil. Did anyone ever tell you that?"
"Miss Granger," Professor Quirrell said gravely, "it can be dangerous to give people compliments like that when they have not been truly earned. The recipient might feel bashful and undeserving and want to do something worthy of your praise. Now, what was it you wanted to talk to me about, Miss Granger?"
It was after lunch, on Thursday afternoon, and Hermione and Harry were ensconced in a little library nook with a quietus field up so they could talk. Harry was lying stomach down on the ground with his elbows resting on the floor and his head in his hands and his feet kicking up casually behind him. Hermione was occupying a stuffed chair much too large for her, like she was the Hermione center of a candy shell. Harry had suggested that they could, as a first pass, read just the titles of all the books in the library, and then Hermione could read all the tables of contents. Hermione had thought this was a brilliant idea. She'd never done that with a library before. Unfortunately, there was a slight flaw in this plan. Namely, they were both Ravenclaws. Hermione was reading a book called Magical Mnemonics. Harry was reading a book called The Skeptical Wizard. Each had thought it was just one special exception they would make only this one time, and neither had yet realized it was impossible for either of them to ever finish reading all the book titles, no matter how hard they tried. The quiet of their little nook was broken by two words.
"Oh, no!"
Harry suddenly said out loud, sounding like the words had been torn out of him. There was a bit more quiet.
"Hey, he didn't!"
Harry said in the same voice. Then she heard Harry start giggling helplessly. Hermione looked up from her book.
"All right,"
she said.
"What is it?"
"I just found out why you never asked the Weasleys about the family rat,"
Harry said.
"It's really awful, and I shouldn't be laughing, and I'm a terrible person."
"Yes,"
Hermione said primly.
"You are. Tell me, too."
Okay. First, the background. There's a whole chapter in this book about Sirius Black conspiracy theories. You remember who that is, right?"
"Of course,"
said Hermione. Sirius Black was a traitor, a friend of James Potter who had let Voldemort into the protected home of the Potters.
"So, it turns out there were a number of, shall we say, irregularities associated with Black going to Azkaban. He didn't get a trial, and the junior minister in charge when the Aurors arrested Black was none other than Cornelius Fudge, who became our current Minister of Magic."
That sounded a little suspicious to Hermione, too, and she said as much. Harry made a shrugging motion with his shoulders as he lay on the floor, looking at his book.
"Suspicious things happen all the time, and if you're a conspiracy theorist, you can always find something."
"But no trial?"
said Hermione.
"It was right after the Dark Lord's defeat,"
Harry said, his voice serious as he said it.
"Things were incredibly chaotic, and when the Aurors tracked down Black, he was standing there laughing in a street, ankle-deep in blood, with 20 eyewitnesses to recount how he'd killed a friend of my father's named Peter Pettigrew, plus 12 bystanders." "I'm not saying I approve of Black not getting a trial, but these are wizards we're talking about here. So it's not really any more suspicious than, I don't know, the sort of thing people point to when they want to argue over who shot John F. Kennedy. So, anyway, Sirius Black is the wizarding Lee Harvey Oswald. There's all sorts of conspiracy theories about who really betrayed my parents instead of him, and one of the favourites is Peter Pettigrew. And this is where it starts getting complicated."
Hermione listened, fascinated.
"But how do we go from there to the Weasley's pet rat?"
"Hold on," said Harry. "I'm getting there. Now, after Pettigrew's death, it came out that he'd been a spy for the Light. Not a double agent, just someone who snuck around and found things out. He'd been good at that since he was a teenager. Even in Hogwarts, he had a reputation for finding out all sorts of secrets. So, the conspiracy theory is that Pettigrew became an unregistered animagus while he was still in Hogwarts. An animagus of something small that could scurry around and listen to conversations. The main problem being that successful animagi are rare, and doing it as a teenager would be really unlikely. So, of course, the conspiracy theory says that my father and Black were unregistered animagi too. And in that conspiracy theory, Pettigrew himself killed the 12 bystanders, turned into his small animagus form, and ran. So, Michael Shermer says there are 4 additional problems with this. 1. Black was the only one besides my parents who knew how to get through the wards around their house.
Harry's voice was a little hard as he said that.
2. Black was a more likely suspect to start with than Pettigrew. There's a rumour Black deliberately tried to get a student killed during his time at Hogwarts, and he was from this really nasty pureblood family. Bellatrix Black was literally his cousin. 3. Black was 20 times the fighting wizard that Pettigrew was, even if he wasn't as smart. The duel between them would have been like Professor Quirrell versus Professor Sprout. Pettigrew probably didn't even get a chance to draw his wand, let alone fake all the evidence the conspiracy theory requires. And 4, Black was standing in the street, laughing.
But the rat?
Said Hermione.
Right.
Harry said.
Well, to make a long story short, Bill Weasley decided that his little brother Percy's pet rat was Pettigrew's animagus form.
Hermione's jaw dropped.
Yes,
Harry said.
You wouldn't exactly expect evil Pettigrew to be living a sad and furtive life as the pet rat of an enemy wizarding family. He'd either be with the Malfoys, or more likely, off in the Caribbean after a bit of plastic surgery. Anyway, Bill knocks out his little brother Percy, stuns and grabs the rat, sends out all these emergency owl messages.
Oh, no!
Hermione said, the words torn out of her.
And, somehow, manages to gather Dumbledore, the Minister of Magic, and the Head Aura.
He didn't,
said Hermione.
And, of course, when they get there, they think he's crazy, but they use Veritas Oculum on the rat anyway, just to be sure, and what do they discover?
She would have died.
A rat?
You win a cookie. So they dragged poor Bill Weasley off to St. Mungo's, and it turned out to be a pretty standard schizophrenic break. It just happens to some people, especially young men around what we'd consider college age. Guy was convinced he was 97 years old and had died and gone back in time to his younger self via train station, and he responded perfectly well to antipsychotics, and he's back to normal, and everything's fine now. Except, people don't talk as much anymore about serious Black conspiracy theories, and you don't ever ask the Weasleys about the family rat.
Hermione was giggling helplessly. It really was awful, and she shouldn't be laughing, and she was a terrible person.
The thing I don't understand,
Harry said after their giggles had died down,
is why Black would hunt down Pettigrew instead of running as fast as he could. He had to know the Aurors would be after him. I wonder if they got the reason out of Black before they took him to Azkaban. See, this is why people who are absolutely, positively guilty still go through the legal system and get trials.
Hermione had to agree with that. Soon, Harry was done with his book, while Hermione was only halfway through hers. Hers was a much more difficult book than Harry's, but she still felt embarrassed about that. And then she had to put magical mnemonics back on the shelf and drag herself away, because it was time for her to face the most dreaded class in Hogwarts. Broomstick riding. Harry tagged along as she walked there, even though his own class wasn't until an hour and a half later, like a fighter jet escorting a sad little propeller plane on its way to its own funeral. The boy wished her goodbye in a quiet, sympathetic voice, and she walked onto the grassy fields of doom. And there was much shrieking, and almost falling, and horrible brushes with death, and the ground in completely the wrong place, and the sun getting in her eyes, and Morag buzzing her, and Mandy thinking she was being subtle about always being near enough to catch her if she fell, and she knew the other students were laughing at both of them, but she never said anything to Mandy because she didn't actually want to die. After 10 million years, the class ended, and she was back on the ground where she belonged until next Thursday. Sometimes she had nightmares about it always being Thursday. Why everyone had to learn this, when they were just going to apparate or flue or portkey everywhere once they grew up, was a complete and utter mystery to Hermione. Nobody actually needed to ride broomsticks as an adult. It was like being forced to play dodgeball in P.E. At least Harry had the decency to be ashamed of being good at it. It was a couple of hours later, and she was in a Hufflepuff study hall with Hannah, Susan, Leanne, and Megan. Professor Flitwick, surprisingly diffident for a teacher, had asked if she might possibly maybe help those four with their charms homework for a while, even though they weren't Ravenclaws, and Hermione had felt so proud she'd almost burst. Hermione took a piece of parchment, spilled a little bit of ink onto it, tore it into four pieces, crumpled them, and tossed the pieces on the table. She could have gotten it just from crumpling it, but doing all that made it more like garbage, and that helped when someone was first practicing the disposal charm. Hermione sharpened her ears and eyes and said,
"Okay, try it. Everto. 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 Everto."
Hermione didn't think she'd quite caught all the problems.
"Can you all try it again?"
An hour later, Hermione had concluded that, one, Leanne and Megan were sort of sloppy, but if you asked them to keep practicing something, they would. Two, Hannah and Susan were focused and driven to the point where you had to keep telling them to slow down and relax and think about things instead of trying so hard. It was odd to think that those two would soon be hers. And three, she liked helping Hufflepuffs. The whole study hall had a very cheerful atmosphere. When she left for dinner, she found the boy who lived reading a book while he waited to escort her. It made her feel flattered, and also a little worried because Harry didn't seem to really talk to anyone besides her.
"Did you know there's a girl in Hufflepuff who's a Metamorph Magus?"
said Hermione as they headed toward the Great Hall.
"She makes her hair really red, like stop sign red, not Weasley red. And when she spilled hot tea on herself, she turned into a blackhead boy until she got it under control again."
"Really? Cool," said Harry, sounding a bit distracted. Hermione, just to check, you know tomorrow's the last day to sign up for Professor Quirrell's armies, right?"
"Yes,"
Hermione said.
"The armies of the evil Professor Quirrell?"
Her voice was a little angry, though Harry didn't know why, of course.
Hermione, Harry said, his voice exasperated. He's not evil. He's a little bit dark, and a whole lot Slytherin. It's not the same as being evil.
Harry Potter had too many words for things. That was his problem. He would have been far better off if he'd just divided the universe into good and bad.
Professor Quirrell called me up in front of the whole class and told me to shoot someone.
He was right, Harry said, his face sober. I'm sorry, Hermione, but he was. You should have shot me. I wouldn't have minded. You can't learn battle magic if you can't practice against real opponents using real spells. And now you're doing okay in sparring, aren't you?
Hermione was only 12, and so she knew, but she couldn't put it into words. She couldn't find the thing to say that would convince Harry. Professor Quirrell had taken a young girl and called up that young girl in front of everyone and ordered her to open fire without provocation on a classmate. It didn't matter if Professor Quirrell was right about needing to learn it. Professor McGonagall wouldn't ever have done that. Professor Flitwick wouldn't ever have done that. Maybe not even Professor Snape would have done that. Professor Quirrell was evil. But she couldn't find the words, and she knew that Harry would never believe her.
Hermione, I've talked to older students, Harry said. Professor Quirrell could be the only competent defense professor we get in all 7 years at Hogwarts. Anything else we can learn later. If we want to study defense, we have to do it this year. The students who sign up for the extracurricular stuff are going to be learning huge amounts, way beyond what the Ministry thinks first years are supposed to study. Did you know we're going to be learning the Patronus Charm? In January.
The Patronus Charm?
Hermione said, her voice going up in surprise. Her book said that was one of the brightest magics known, a weapon against the darkest creatures, cast with pure positive emotions. It wasn't something she'd expect the evil Professor Quirrell to teach, or arrange to be taught, since Hermione couldn't imagine he could do the spell himself.
Yes, Harry said. Students don't usually learn the Patronus Charm until their 5th years or even later. But Professor Quirrell says the Ministry schedules are made up by talking flubberworms, and the ability to cast the Patronus Charm depends on emotions more than magical strength. Professor Quirrell says that he thinks most students do way less than they can, and this year he's going to prove it.
There was the usual tone of awed worship that Harry's voice had when he talked about Professor Quirrell, and Hermione gritted her teeth and kept walking.
I already signed up, actually,
Hermione said, her voice a little quiet.
I did it this morning. For everything, just like you said.
In for a penny, in for a pound, was the usual expression. Besides, she didn't want to lose, and if she wanted to win, she had to learn.
So, you will be in the armies, then?
Harry's voice was suddenly enthusiastic.
That's awesome, Hermione. I've already got my list of soldiers, but I'm sure Professor Quirrell will let me add one more, or trade.
I'm not joining your army.
Hermione's voice was sharp. She knew it was a reasonable assumption, but it still annoyed her. Harry blinked.
Not Draco Malfoy's. Surely. So you want to be in the Third Army, even though we don't know who the general is yet?
Harry sounded surprised, and a little worried, and she couldn't blame him. Though, of course, she did blame him, since, in fact, it was all his fault.
But why not mine?
Think about it,
Hermione snapped.
And and maybe you'll work it out."
And she sped up her stride and left Harry gaping behind her.
"Professor Quirrell," Draco said in his most formal voice, "I must protest your appointment of Hermione Granger as the third general."
"Oh?" said Professor Quirrell, leaning back in his chair in his casual and relaxed manner.
"Protest away, Mr. Malfoy."
"Granger is unfit for the position," said Draco.
Professor Quirrell tapped a finger on his cheek thoughtfully.
"Why, yes. Yes, she is. Do you have any further protests?"
"Professor Quirrell," said Harry Potter beside him, "with all due respect to Miss Granger's many outstanding academic talents, and the Quirrell point she has justly earned in your classes, her personality is not suited to military command."
Draco had been relieved when Harry had agreed to accompany him to Professor Quirrell's office. It wasn't just that Harry was a gigantic, blatant teacher's pet where Professor Quirrell was concerned. Draco had also started to worry that Harry actually was friends with Granger. It had been a while now, and he still hadn't made his move. But this was way more like it.
"I agree with Mr. Potter," said Draco. "Appointing her as a general turns it into a farce."
"Harshly put," said Harry, "but I cannot bring myself to disagree with Mr. Malfoy. To be blunt, Professor Quirrell, Hermione Granger has around as much intent to kill as a bowl of wet grapes."
"That," said Professor Quirrell mildly, "is not a thing I would fail to notice myself. You are telling me nothing I do not already know."
It was Draco's turn to say something, but the conversation had suddenly hiccuped. That answer had not been in the possibilities he and Harry had brainstormed before coming here. "What did you say after the teacher said that he knew everything you knew, and he was still going to commit an obvious mistake?" The silence stretched.
"Is this some sort of plot?" Harry said slowly.
"Must everything I do be some sort of plot?" said Professor Quirrell. "Can't I ever create chaos just for the sake of chaos?"
Draco almost choked.
"Not in your battle magic class,"
Harry said with calm certainty.
"Other places, maybe, but not there."
Professor Quirrell slowly raised his eyebrows. Harry gazed steadily back at him. Draco shivered.
"Well, then," Professor Quirrell said, "neither of you seem to have considered a very simple question. Who could I appoint instead of Miss Granger?"
"Blaise Sabini,"
Draco said without hesitation.
"Any other suggestions?"
said Professor Quirrell, sounding quite amused. Anthony Goldstein and Ernie Macmillan came to thought before Draco's common sense kicked in and ruled out Mudbloods and Hufflepuffs no matter how aggressively they duelled. So, instead, Draco just said,
"What's wrong with Sabini?"
"I see,"
Harry said slowly.
"I don't," said Draco. "Why not Sabini?"
Professor Quirrell looked at Draco.
"Because Mr. Malfoy, no matter how hard he tries, he'll never be able to keep up with you or Mr. Potter."
The shock of it staggered Draco.
"You can't believe Granger is going to..."
"He he's gambling on her, Harry said quietly. It's not guaranteed. The odds aren't even good. She'll probably never give us a good fight. And even if she does, it may take her months to learn. But she's the only one in our year with any chance at all of growing to beat us.
Draco's hands twitched, but didn't clench into fists. Showing up as your supporter and then backing out was a classic undermining tactic. So, Harry Potter was in it with Granger. And that implied...
But, Professor, Harry went on smoothly, I'm worried Hermione will be miserable as the general of an army. I'm speaking as her friend now, Professor Quirrell. The competition might be good for Draco and me, but what you're asking her to do isn't good for her.
Never mind.
Your friendship for Hermione Granger does you credit, Professor Quirrell said dryly. Especially as you are able to be friends with Draco Malfoy at the same time. Quite a feat, that.
Harry suddenly looked a little nervous, meaning he probably felt a lot more nervous, and Draco silently swore to himself.
Of course Harry wasn't going to fool Professor Quirrell. And I doubt Miss Granger would appreciate your friendly concern, said Professor Quirrell. She asked me for the position, Mr. Potter. I did not ask her.
Harry was quiet at this for a moment. Then he flashed Draco a quick look that mixed apology and warning, saying at the same time, Sorry, I did my best, and we'd better not press it any further.
As for her being miserable,
Professor Quirrell went on, a slight smile now playing about his lips.
I suspect that she will have a much easier time with the rigors of her position than either of you suspect, and that she will put up a good fight much sooner than you think.
Harry and Draco both gasped in horror.
You're not going to advise her, are you?
Said Draco, utterly aghast.
I never signed up to fight you, said Harry.
The smile playing around Professor Quirrell's lips grew wider.
As a matter of fact, I did offer to share a few suggestions regarding Miss Granger's first battles.
Professor Quirrell, said Harry.
Oh, don't worry, Professor Quirrell said. She turned me down, just as I expected.
Draco's eyes narrowed.
Dear me, Mr. Potter, said Professor Quirrell. Didn't anyone ever tell you it's rude to stare?
You're not going to secretly help her some other way, are you?
Said Harry.
Would I do that?
Said Professor Quirrell.
Yes!
Said Draco and Harry at the same time.
I am wounded by your lack of trust. Well then, I promise not to help General Granger in any way that the two of you don't know about. And now, I suggest that both of you be about your military affairs. November approaches, and swiftly.
Draco saw the implications before the door had closed all the way behind them on their way out of Professor Quirrell's office. Harry had once spoken dismissively of people stuff. And now that was Draco's only hope. Let him not realize. Let him not realize.
We should just attack the Granger girl first and get her out of our way, said Draco. After we crush her, we can have our own contest without any distractions.
Now, that doesn't really seem fair to her, does it?
Said Harry in a mild voice.
What do you care?
Said Draco.
She's your rival, right?
Then, with just the right note of suspicion in his voice,
Don't tell me you've started really liking her after being her rival all this time. Founders forbid, said Harry. What can I say, Draco? I merely have a natural sense of justice. Granger does too, you know. She has a very firm grasp on good and evil, and she's probably going to attack evil first. Having a name like Malfoy is just asking for it, you know? Damn it! Harry!
Said Draco, sounded wounded and maybe a little superior.
Don't you want to fight fairly against me? You mean, rather than attacking you after you've already lost some of your forces beating Granger?
Said Harry.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe after I get bored with just winning, I'll try that fair thing. Maybe she'll attack you,
said Draco.
You're her rival. But I'm her friendly rival,
Harry said with an evil grin.
I bought her a nice birthday present and everything. You wouldn't go around sabotaging your friendly rival like that.
What about sabotaging your friend's chance at a fair fight?
Said Draco angrily.
I thought we were friends. Let me rephrase that, said Harry. Granger wouldn't sabotage a friendly rival, but that's because she has the killing intention of a bowl of wet grapes. You would. You totally would. And guess what? So would I. Damn it!
If it had been a play, there would have been dramatic music. The hero, impeccably turned out in green-trimmed robes and perfectly combed white blonde hair, faced the villain. The villain, leaning back in a simple wooden chair with her buck teeth clearly visible and stray chestnut curls drifting over her cheeks, faced the hero. It was Wednesday, October 30th, and the first battle was coming up on Sunday. Draco was standing in General Granger's office, a room the size of a small classroom. Why each general's office was so large, Draco wasn't quite sure. A chair and a desk would have worked for him. He wasn't even clear on why the generals needed offices at all. His soldiers knew where to find him. Unless Professor Quirrell had deliberately arranged the huge offices for them as a sign of status, in which case Draco was all for it. Granger sat on the room's single chair like a throne, all the way on the other end of the office from where the door opened. There was a long, oblong table stretched across the middle of the room between them, and four small, circular tables scattered around the corners, but only that one single chair, all the way at the opposite end. The room had windows along one wall, and a beam of sunlight touched the top of Granger's hair, like a glowing crown. It would have been nice if Draco could have walked slowly forward, but there was a table in the way, and Draco had to go around it diagonally, and there was no good way to do that in a dramatic and dignified fashion. Had that been deliberate? If it had been his father, it surely would have been. But this was Granger, so surely not. There was nowhere for him to sit, and Granger hadn't stood up either. Draco kept the outrage entirely off his face.
"Well, Mr. Draco Malfoy,"
Granger said once he stood before her,
"you requested an audience with me, and I have been so gracious as to grant it. What was your plea?"
"Come with me to visit Malfoy Manor. My father and I would like to show you some interesting spells."
Your rival, Potter, came to me with an offer, said Draco, putting a serious look on his face. He doesn't mind losing to me, but would be humiliated if you won. So he wants to join me and wipe you out immediately. Not just in our first battle. All of them. If I won't do that, Potter wants me to hold back or harass you while he launches an all-out attack on you as his first move.
I see, Granger said, looking surprised. And you're offering to help me against him?
Of course, said Draco smoothly. I didn't think what he wanted to do to you was fair.
Why, that's very nice of you, Mr. Malfoy,
said Granger.
I'm sorry for how I spoke to you earlier. We should be friends. Can I call you Drakey?
Alarm bells started to sound in Draco's head, but there was a chance she meant it. Of course, said Draco. If I can call you Hermy.
Draco was pretty sure he saw her expression flicker.
Anyway, Draco said, I was thinking it would serve Potter right if we both attacked him and wiped him out.
But that wouldn't be fair to Mr. Potter, would it?
Said Granger. I think it'd be very fair, Draco said. He was planning to do it to you first.
Granger was giving him a stern look that could possibly have intimidated him if he'd been a Hufflepuff instead of a Malfoy.
You think I'm pretty stupid, don't you, Mr. Malfoy?
Draco smiled charmingly.
No, Miss Granger, but I thought I'd at least check. So, what do you want?
Are you offering to bribe me?
Said Granger.
Sure, said Draco. Can I just slip you a galleon and have you beat on Potter instead of me for the rest of the year?
No,
said Granger.
But you can offer me 10 galleons and have me attack both of you equally instead of just you.
10 galleons is a lot of money, Draco said cautiously.
I didn't know the Malfoys were poor, said Granger.
Draco stared at Granger. He was starting to get a strange feeling about this. That particular reply didn't seem like it should have come from this particular girl.
Well, said Draco, you don't get to be rich by wasting money, you know.
I don't know if you know what a dentist is, Mr. Malfoy, but my parents are dentists, and anything less than 10 galleons isn't worth my time at all.
3 galleons, Draco said, more as a probe than anything else.
No,
said Granger.
If you want an equal fight at all, I don't believe that a Malfoy wants an equal fight less than he wants 10 galleons.
Draco was starting to get a very strange feeling about this.
No, said Draco.
No,
said Granger.
This is a limited-time offer, Mr. Malfoy. Are you sure you want to risk a whole year of being miserably crushed by the boy who lived? That would be pretty embarrassing for the House of Malfoy, wouldn't it?
It was a very persuasive argument, one that was hard to refuse. But you didn't get rich by spending money when your heart told you it was a set-up.
No, said Draco.
See you on Sunday,
said Granger. Draco turned and walked out of the office without another word. That had been not right.
Hermione, Harry said patiently, we're supposed to be plotting against each other. You could even betray me, and it wouldn't mean anything outside the battlefield.
Hermione shook her head.
It wouldn't be nice, Harry.
Harry sighed.
I don't think you're getting into the spirit of this at all.
It wouldn't be nice,
she'd actually said that. Hermione didn't know whether to be insulted at what Harry thought of her, or worried about whether she really did sound like that much of a goody-two-shoes usually. It was probably time to change the subject.
"Anyway, are you doing anything special for tomorrow?"
said Hermione.
"It's..."
Her voice cut off abruptly as she realized. "Yes, Hermione," Harry said a little tightly.
"What day is it?"
Interlude. There was a time when October the 31st had been called Halloween in magical Britain. Now, it was Harry Potter Day. Harry had turned down all the offers, even the one from Minister Fudge, which might have been good for future political favours, and which he really should have gritted his teeth and taken. But to Harry, October the 31st would always be the Dark Lord Killed My Parents Day. There should have been a quiet, dignified memorial service somewhere, and if there was one, he hadn't been invited. Hogwarts got the day off to celebrate. Even the Slytherins didn't dare wear black outside their own dorm. There were special events and special foods, and the teachers looked the other way if anyone ran through the hallways. It was the 10th anniversary, after all. Harry spent the day in his trunk so as to not spoil it for anyone else, eating snack bars in place of meals, reading some of his sadder science fiction books, no fantasy, and writing a letter to Mum and Dad that was much longer than the ones he usually sent.
"Hello there, it's me, Jack Voraces. Thanks for listening so far. You reached the end of what I've recorded thus far. The next chapter will be published next Tuesday. I also want to invite you to my Discord server, where you can listen to live recordings. We have a good laugh, discuss the story, and decide on character voices together. Come and join. I really hope to see you there. You can find a link in the description, or just Google search for Voraces Tavern Discord. You legends."
Chapter 30. Working in Groups, Part 1. The day was Sunday, November 3rd, and soon the three great powers of their school year, Harry Potter, Draco Malfoy, and Hermione Granger, would begin their struggle for supreme dominance. Harry was slightly annoyed by the way the boy who lived had been demoted from supreme dominance to one of three equal rivals just by entering the contest, but he expected to get it back soon. The battleground was a section of non-forbidden forest, dense with trees, because Professor Quirrell thought that being able to see all the enemy forces was too boring, even for your very first battle. All the students who were not actually in a first-year army were camped out nearby and watching on screens that Professor Quirrell had set up, except for three Gryffindors in their fourth year, who were currently sick and confined to healers' beds by Madame Pomfrey. Aside from that, everyone was there. The students were dressed, not in their ordinary school robes, but in Muggle camouflage uniforms that Professor Quirrell had obtained somewhere and supplied in sufficient quantity and variety to fit everyone. It wasn't that students would have worried about stains and rips. That was what charms were for. But, as Professor Quirrell had explained to the surprised Wizardborns, nice, dignified clothing was not efficient for hiding in forests or dodging around trees. And, on each uniform's breast, a patch bearing the name and insignia of your army. A small patch. If you wanted your soldiers to wear
say, coloured ribbons so that they could identify each other at a distance and risk the enemy getting their hands on the ribbons, that was all up to you. Harry had tried to get the name Dragon Army. Draco had pitched a fit and said that would confuse everyone completely. Professor Quirrell had ruled that Draco could lay prior claim to the name, if he wished. So now Harry was fighting Dragon Army. This probably wasn't a good sign. For their insignia, instead of the too obvious dragon's head breathing fire, Draco had elected to simply go with the fire. Elegant, understated, deadly. That's what's left after we've passed. Very Malfoy. Harry, after considering alternate choices such as the 501st Provisional Battalion and Harry's Minions Are Doom, had decided that his army would be known by the simple and dignified appellation of the Chaos Legion. Their insignia was a hand poised with fingers ready to snap. It was universally agreed that this wasn't a good sign. Harry had earnestly advised Hermione that the young boys serving under her were probably nervous about her being a girl with a reputation for being nice, and that she should pick something scary that would reassure them of her toughness and make them proud to be part of her army, like the Blood Commandos or something. Hermione had named her army the Sunshine Regiment. Their insignia was a smiley face. And in 10 minutes, they would be at war. Harry stood in the bright forest clearing that was their assigned starting location, an area of open space with old and rotting tree stumps that had been cleared away for some unknown purpose, ground coated with a small scattering of blown leaves and the dried grey remnants of grass that had failed to test the summer's heat, and the sun shining down brilliantly from above. Around him were the 23 soldiers that Professor Quirrell had assigned to him. Nearly all of Gryffindor had signed up, of course, and more than half of Slytherin, and less than half of Hufflepuff, and a handful of Ravenclaw. In Harry's army, there were 12 Gryffindors, and 6 Slytherins, and 4 Hufflepuffs, and 1 Ravenclaw, besides himself. Not that there was any way to tell that by looking at the uniforms. No red, no green, no yellow, no blue. Just muggle camouflage patterns and a patch on the breast with the device of a hand poised to snap its fingers. Harry looked upon his 23 soldiers, all wearing the same uniforms with no marks of group identity, save that single patch. And lo, Harry smiled, because he understood what this part of Professor Quirrell's master plan was about, and Harry was taking full advantage of it for his own purposes, too. There was a legendary episode in social psychology called the Robber's Cave Experiment. It had been set up in the bewildered aftermath of World War II, with the intent of investigating the causes and remedies of conflicts between groups. The scientists had set up a summer camp for 22 boys from 22 different schools, selecting them to all be from stable, middle-class families. The first phase of the experiment had been intended to investigate what it took to start a conflict between groups. The 22 boys had been divided into 2 groups of 11. And this had been quite sufficient. The hostility had started from the moment the 2 groups had become aware of each other's existences in the state park, insults being hurled on the first meeting. They'd named themselves the Eagles and the Rattlers. They hadn't needed names for themselves when they thought they were the only ones in the park, and had proceeded to develop contrasting group stereotypes. the rattlers thinking of themselves as rough and tough, and swearing heavily, the eagles correspondingly deciding to think of themselves as upright and proper. The other part of the experiment had been testing how to resolve group conflicts. Bringing the boys together to watch fireworks hadn't worked at all. They'd just shouted at each other and stayed apart. What had worked was warning them that there might be vandals in the park, and the two groups needed to work together to solve a failure of the park's water system. A common task, a common enemy. Harry had a strong suspicion Professor Quirrell had understood this principle very well indeed when he had chosen to create 3 armies per year. 3 armies. Not 4. And definitely not segregated by house. Except that no Slytherins had been assigned to Draco besides Mr. Crabbe and Mr. Goyle. It was things like this which reassured Harry that Professor Quirrell, despite his affected dark atmosphere and his pretense of neutrality in the conflict between good and evil, was secretly backing good. Not that Harry would ever dare say that out loud. And Harry had decided to take full advantage of Professor Quirrell's plan to define a group identity his way. The Rattlers, once they'd met the Eagles, had started thinking of themselves as rough and tough, and they'd conducted themselves accordingly. The Eagles had thought of themselves as good and proper. And in that bright forest clearing, scattered around the old and rotting tree stumps, outlined in the sun shining down brilliantly from above, General Potter and his 23 soldiers were arranged in nothing remotely resembling a formation. Some soldiers stood, some soldiers sat, some stood on one leg, just to be different. It was the Chaos Legion, after all. And if there wasn't a reason to stand in neat little lines, Harry had said, disdainfully, there weren't going to be neat little lines. Harry had divided the army into 6 squads of 4 soldiers each, each squad commanded by a squad suggester. All troops were under strict orders to disobey any orders they were given if it seemed like a good idea at the time, including that one, unless Harry or the squad suggester prefixed the order with "Merlin says," in which case you were supposed to actually obey. The Chaos Legion's chief attack was to split up and run in multiple directions, randomly changing vectors and firing the approved sleep spell as rapidly as you could rebuild the magical strength. And if you saw a chance to distract or confuse the enemy, you took it. Fast, creative, unpredictable, non-homogeneous. Don't just obey orders. Think about whether what you're doing right now makes sense. Harry wasn't quite as sure as he'd pretended that this was the optimum of military efficiency, but he had been given a golden opportunity to change how some students thought about themselves, and that was how he intended to use it. 5 minutes to wartime, according to Harry's watch. General Potter walked, not marched, over to where his Air Force was waiting tensely, broomsticks already clutched firmly in their hands.
"All wings report in," said General Potter.
They'd rehearsed this during their one training session on Saturday.
"Red leader, standing boy,"
said Seamus Finnegan, who had no idea what it meant.
"Red 5, standing by," said Dean Thomas,
who'd waited his entire life to say it.
"Green leader, standing by,"
Theodore Knott said rather stiffly.
"Green 41, standing by,"
Tracy Davis said.
"I want you in the air the instant we hear the bell," said General Potter. "Do not engage. Repeat, do not engage. Evade if under fire."
Of course, you did not aim sleep spells at broomsticks. You fired a spell that gave a temporary red glow to whatever it hit. If you hit the broomstick or the rider, they were out of the war.
Red Leader and Red Five, fly toward Malfoy's army as fast as you can. Stay as high as you can while still seeing them. Return the instant you know for sure what they're doing. Green Leader, do the same for Granger's army. Green 41, fly above us and watch for any approaching broomsticks or soldiers. You, and only you, are authorized to fire. And remember, I didn't say Merlin says for any of that. But we do really need the information. For chaos!
For chaos! For chaos!
For chaos!
For chaos!
The four echoed with varying degrees of enthusiasm. Harry expected Hermione to launch an immediate attack on Draco, in which case he'd move his troops into position and start supporting her, but only after she'd taken severe losses and caused some damage. He would frame it as a heroic rescue, if possible. It wouldn't do to have Sunshine thinking that Chaos wasn't their friend, after all. But, just in case she didn't, well, that was why the Chaos Legion was staying put until Green Leader reported back. Draco's moves would be in his own self-interest. He would predictably ready his army to defend against Hermione. He might, or might not, realize that Harry had been lying about waiting to attack until after that battle finished. Harry had still put two broomsticks on Dragon Army, just in case they were doing something, and just in case Draco or Mr. Goyle or Mr. Crab was good enough to shoot a broomstick out of the sky. But General Granger was the unpredictable one, and Harry couldn't move until he knew how she was moving. In the heart of the forest, with shadow patterns dancing on the ground as leafy canopies swayed high above, General Malfoy stood where the trees were relatively sparser, and looked out on his troops with calm satisfaction. 6 units of 3 troops each, the aerial unit of 4, to which Gregory was assigned, and the command unit, which was himself and Vincent. They'd only drilled for a short time on the previous Saturday, but Draco was confident that he'd managed to explain the basics. Stay with your mates, watch their back, and trust them to watch yours. Move as a single body. Obey orders and show no fear. Aim, fire, move, aim again, fire again. The 6 units were formed up in a defensive perimeter around Draco, watchfully gazing outward into the forest. Back to back they stood, wands gripped low until they needed to strike. They already looked remarkably like the aura units whose training Draco had watched during his father's inspections. Chaos and Sunshine weren't going to know what hit them.
Attention! Said General Malfoy.
The 6 units unfolded and spun toward Draco. The faces of his broomstick riders turned from where they stood with broomsticks already in hand. Draco had decided to wait on demanding salutes until after they won their first battle, when Gryffindors and Hufflepuffs would be more willing to salute a Malfoy. But his soldiers were already standing straight enough, especially the Gryffindors, that Draco wondered if he'd even needed to delay. Gregory had quietly listened and reported back that Draco's volunteering to stand by Harry Potter in defense class, that time when Professor Quirrell had taught Harry how to lose, had marked Draco as an acceptable commander. At least if you happened to be assigned to his army. Not all Slytherins are alike. There are Slytherins, and then there are Slytherins, was what the Gryffindors in Draco's army were quoting to their housemates. Draco was frankly astounded at how incredibly easy that had been. Draco had protested at first about not being assigned any Slytherins, and Professor Quirrell had told him that if he wanted to be the first Malfoy to gain complete political control of the country, he needed to learn how to govern the other 3/4 of the population. It was things like this which reassured Draco that Professor Quirrell had a great deal more sympathy for the good guys than Professor Quirrell was letting on. The actual battle wouldn't be easy, especially if Granger did attack the dragons first. Draco had agonized over whether to commit all his forces against Granger immediately in a preemptive strike, but had worried that, one, Harry had been misleading him completely about what Granger was likely to do, and, two, Harry had been misleading him about waiting until after Granger's attack to join the battle. Though, Dragon Army had a secret weapon, 3 of them in fact, which might be enough to win, even if they were attacked by both armies at once. It was almost time, and that meant it was time for the pre-battle speech that Draco had composed and memorized.
"The battle is about to begin," Draco said. His voice was calm and precise. "Remember everything that I and Mr. Crab and Mr. Goyle showed you. An army wins because it is disciplined and deadly. General Potter and the Chaos Legion will not be disciplined. Granger and the Sunshine Regiment will not be deadly. We are disciplined. We are deadly. We are dragons. The battle